Ron and Anian.
You know it's Friday the 13th when you go to take the plastic plug out the top of the trans and it snaps.
Go ahead, jump. Jump.
The Car Doctor.
20 years ago, it wasn't as important, but nowadays, vehicles are just big rolling computers, and you've got to be sure that the jump pack, when used, and isn't going to hurt the electronics.
Welcome to the radio home of Ron and Anian, the Car Doctor. Since 1991, this is where car owners the world over turn to for their definitive opinion on automotive repair. If your mechanic's giving you a busy signal, pick up the phone and call in. The garage doors are open.
But I am here to take your calls at 855-560-9900.
And now, here's Ronnie.
Hey, welcome to the best in automotive talk radio. Ron and Andy and the Car Doctor at your service. A lot going on in the next couple of hours. We're going to be talking to Mike Muller during this next hour with his comments. And how did he come to write the book, The Complete Book of Corvette? We're giving away a copy of The Complete Book of Corvette next weekend, so you want to be sure you're here for that as well. If you're into Corvettes, if you've got someone that's into Corvettes, holiday gift giving, that kind of thing, we're trying to help, and that's what The Car Doctor is all about. We want to help. We're going to take that week I just spent in the shop that I have for the past, well, let's see, I've spent every week in the shop for the past 45 years, and we're going to convert that into this radio show over the next couple of hours, so stick around. You're going to hear us talking all about cars. Let's get over to Gary in Pennsylvania. Let's start off right off the bat and kick the garage doors open. 04 Nissan Pathfinder. Gary, welcome to the Car Doctor, sir. How can I help?
Hey, Ron, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome. What's cooking?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. Well, I've got this 2000 Nissan Pathfinder, and you know, it's great vehicle, great shape, 110,000 miles, but the exhaust system's starting to show its age.
Okay.
So, you know, it's really kind of, I had a pipe crack that's now been sleeved, but the muffler is starting to come apart and delaminate, and I think it's time for a new system. And I've been researching things on the internet, and everybody makes a claim that they're lifetime warranty, great product, but you know how that goes.
Yeah.
So I didn't know, in your experience, I'm not looking for performance enhancements. I'm not looking to change the sound of the vehicle.
Okay.
I just want a replacement system that's going to last.
So let's come at this from the price is no reasonable object conversation, and then we can work it down from there. All right, Gary? This is an 04 or a 2000? Which is it? Not that it really matters a whole lot. Go ahead.
It's an 04.
It's an 04. So this is an 04. So it's 16 years old, 17 model years old. So original exhaust, I'm sure. Look how long it lasted, right? And if you price a typical aftermarket exhaust, and by that I mean some of the companies that are making aluminized pipes, you would probably have changed that exhaust system by now. You would have changed that exhaust system 4 or 5 times. Because my experience has been the aftermarket versions of aluminized pipe exhaust systems, which, you know, meets the needs of some people. They're keeping the car for another 2 to 4 years. That replacement system will last 2 to 4 years, and it sort of gets them through that moment. If you're thinking long term, you know, if it's still available, you have to go talk to Nissan. But you have to ask the right questions. First question being is the Nissan replacement system stainless steel? Because I can almost guarantee you that original system you've got is stainless steel. It's probably stainless with an exhaust flange that's just regular stamped steel. That's what they seem to do. And it's probably breaking at the flanges, and then the shield, the heat shield that goes around the big giant muffler has started to rot, and it's sort of curled up like an ear of corn would peel, correct? It's just starting to peel itself?
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much exactly what I've got.
Yeah.
Right now.
And the thing is, it's nice. You know, the aftermarket will have a reasonable replacement for it. But, you know, it's you're going to get 2.5-3 years out of it, depending on how you drive. And that's okay.
Yeah,
they'll give you a limited lifetime warranty, but, you know, how many times do you want to change it? And that's...
Well, and I've seen in some cases where the limited warranty is only covers manufacturing defects.
And
it doesn't cover rust and corrosion.
Right, and it may only... Or it may cover the muffler, not the pipes. And
right.
Now, but, you know, then we have to have this conversation. So you'll go price that system out of Nissan, and if that is real Nissan exhaust. And by that I mean Nissan, like a lot of the manufacturers, has come out with their own economy version of exhaust. They're trying to, you know, lay part of the aftermarket, because most people don't think the way you're thinking, to be honest. Most people are, how cheap can I get an exhaust system, not how good.
Right.
All right. And that's the difference. Right. So that exhaust system from Nissan, stainless steel, depending upon how much of it you're buying, I'll say from the converter back, not counting the converters, could be $1,200 to $1,500 just in parts. All right.
Yeah, and I've got a good friend called John Opel, who's a highly credentialed GM tech, and he looks after our vehicles, even though none of them are GM. But he's the one who advised me. He said, stick with the original exhaust as long as you can, because it's going to be better than anything you're going to replace it.
Right, and I agree with that. If you're in this for the long haul, Gary, then yeah, while you can still get it. But my point is, I don't know if Nissan still has that system available at that same level as what they originally sold you.
Yeah. So you think they could have something that's lower quality,
right,
versus the original one?
You could be buying a Nissan branded aluminized exhaust pipe. Same thing. You could be buying the exact same thing. And that's why your question to Nissan has to be, is this a stainless system or is this aluminized pipe? And I'm willing to bet it's going to be aluminized pipe. I don't think it's going to be the tried and true what you're expecting, because I know what you're looking for. And Nissan, I've had this experience with them more than once where, and I'll have this exact conversation with customers where, you know, we want exhaust, we want the best, so on and so forth. And my numbers probably aren't wrong. It's probably $1,200 to $1,500 for the Y pipe, the muffler, and the axle pipe. And you know, and heaven help you if you need catalytic converters. They're easily $800 to $900 a piece, depending upon which version Pathfinder this is. So, but Monday, you know, it's Monday. Let's make a call to the Nissan store. Stop by the dealership. Tell them what you're looking for. You just want to buy parts, and then ask the parts guy, "Is this?" And you'll know right away if that Nissan exhaust system is, you know, $500 worth of widgets instead of $1,500 worth of widgets. No way that's stainless. And you'll know what you're getting.
Well, I've seen some of them. And I've been poking around on the internet. And Walker, for example, makes a stainless steel exhaust for this vehicle.
Okay.
But again, you know, I mean, there's 409 stainless, and you're more knowledgeable about this than I am. But, you know, I'm seeing some of these things out there, but I realize there's different qualities of stainless steel, too.
True.
And I think your advice is great. If I can get what I have now.
Right.
And replace it with that.
Right.
But I think that's what I'd probably be best doing.
But you know, also remember, Gary,
I can't get that.
Don't overthink it. Well, if you can't get that, then you've got to decide. Do you want to try the aftermarket version of stainless for that car? That's not a bad idea. You have to look at cost factor. You've got to look at, you know, how easily does this come apart? Does the aftermarket version have the correct hangers, shields, and brackets? Because I can tell you right now,
they say they do.
Trust me, they say they do somehow.
Yeah, right.
And I will say this: Walker has gotten better. I'll use your example because you named them. Walker has gotten better. All right. They do make a better system today than they did just 5 years ago. 5 years ago, it was put it on, heat it up, bend it, bang it, and make it fit. But just look at this particular system. Their version of that front pipe where the heat shield is going to be, they've just got some tabs welded that they expect you to be able to remove your heat shields and attach them to that pipe. We're from Nissan. I believe that heat shield is either going to be attached to the pipe or available directly, and you can buy a new one from Nissan that will fit that Nissan pipe. So, you know, a lot of this is homework. A lot of this is looking at what's available, what do you have. But bottom line, if you want something that's going to last as long, then you really want to take a look at that Nissan system, all right? From there, work your way down. Performance system, nah, I don't think you want to go there with this. You're looking for durability. Now, if you do put an aluminized pipe system on from Walker or Nissan or whoever, also consider painting the system. heat paint, VHT, or some other reasonable substitute. You know, they do make some very nice paints today that are good up to 1,800 degrees, header paint, things that take high heat. Painting the system every couple of months will, you know, extend the life of it and, you know, prevent the rust and prevent it from going this way. And sometimes that's an alternative. Sometimes you can sit there and say a can of paint is less expensive than a stainless steel system front to back. So that's an alternative too. Good luck in whatever you do, Gary. Keep it going. And I appreciate the call. You're thinking along the right way, my friend. Just go out and get some more information and you'll be just fine. 855-560-9900. Ron and Andy, the Car Doctor, coming back right after this.
Keep Ron's number handy, 855-560-9900, for when you really need advice on your car. Here's Ron.
Hey, let's get over and talk to Jose in Massachusetts, 12 Dodge Durango. Jose, welcome to the Car Doctor. How can I help?
Thank you. I appreciate you calling back.
You're very welcome. What's going on?
Okay, I have this 2012 Dodge Journey with a 3.6, and I've been losing antifreeze. I have to fill it up every one or two weeks, probably a quarter or so. And what I did, you know, before doing anything, taking anything apart, I did a pressure test on the system. I put the pressure tester, it went up 13 to 15 pounds, and it held for about maybe a minute or two, and then it started losing pressure to about 5 pounds.
Okay.
So I am losing pressure somewhere.
Okay. So if you're losing, if you're not able to maintain pressure and you're pushing, you know, a 10, 12-pound pressure drop out somewhere, you should see coolant puddling under this vehicle. And the only reason I say it like that, Jose, is to start, you know, and I'm being fussy, but that's what I'm supposed to do. How do we know the pressure tester is any good? And how do we know that the connection at the radiator cap, however you've got it connected, is a good seal? Did you think of that? Did you test that? Because if you're not seeing coolant, and I'm not saying you don't have a coolant leak, I'm just trying to, you know, make sure the test results are as accurate as I can make them.
Well, the tester is a new tester. I rented out from Napa Auto Parts.
Okay.
And it was a basically new one. But what I did see, after I did this, I took a light, okay? And I took a light and I looked the intake sits on the engine block.
Right, down under by the oil filter?
Yeah, and there's a lot of antifreeze there.
Okay, so you've got a coolant leak down under the intake plenum.
Yep.
More than likely, this is a 3.6 V6?
Yep.
Right, this has the tried and true oil filter housing coolant leak under the intake where you'll take the intake manifold off. That filter housing has to be replaced. It's leaking somewhere from there. All right.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. What you can do is you can take the intake off. I don't know that you can run the pressure test anymore because I think you're going to open up a coolant port. But what you may want to do prior to taking it apart is go back to your Napa Auto Parts store or wherever you're going. Do you have the ability to do a cooling system dye test?
Yes.
So, you know, put some dye into the coolant, let it run, let it circulate. Don't pressure test it. Just let it run by normal means. All right. Wash off, you know, take the intake off. Let me think how we want to do this. I want you to wash out that area under the intake as best you can. All right.
Okay.
And then add the dye. Then, you know, then run the car, then take the intake off. I'm just trying to make it a little easier to see because I can imagine. I know what happens. It gets to be a pool of oil and coolant down there. I won't be surprised if you went and looked that you were leaking oil as well. And those housings, they do fail. So it's not uncommon. You're either going to take a look at Chrysler, I think they're $400-500 for the housing assembly, if I remember right. You may find it just as a casual conversation. You may want to check DormanProducts.com and see if Dorman is remanufacturing that assembly yet, because that would be typical of them to come up with something at a lower cost alternative than what the manufacturer is doing, because that's a very common failure item. So you can go on their website, DormanProducts.com. You know, go on by year, make, model.
That was my next question.
Yeah.
My next question is, should I go with a Mopar or should I go with an aftermarket? Because I've seen a lot of different people saying that, you know, even though it's going to fail eventually in the future, you know, and the aftermarket tends to fail sooner than the Mopar OE.
I've seen it both ways. What it really comes down to is, what are your long-term plans? If you're planning to keep the vehicle for a while, that's one thing. And then the second comment is, you know, what's in the budget? And you've got to look at price, because I've seen that part out of Chrysler where it's frightfully expensive on some of these models. I've seen $400-$500, and then I've seen $200-$250 in the aftermarket. It's half the price, and you know if this is a 6 month car, you're keeping it until the spring, I would put the aftermarket piece on.
Yeah, I'm keeping it for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah, if you're keeping it for a long time, you know, and again, it'll just come down to budget. What's the budget? What's the long term plan for it? And you know, where do you want to go with it? So those are the kind of things you got to look at. All right, kiddo. Good luck to you. You let me know if you have anything else I can do for you. Like I said, add the dye, take the plenum off, and you'll know where to go at that point. You can lay out. You know, make sure wherever you get it from, there's a couple of gaskets and O-rings involved in the housing that you want to make sure you get as well. And while you're there, you might as well make plans to change the oil too, because, you know, you're going to take the whole thing apart. Quite a bit of oil in there. Don't be surprised. You'll be amazed how much oil that holds. Let's do a couple of emails. Hey, Ron, love the show. Listening to all the podcasts, can't get enough. Let's see, this is from Dale. Thanks for all the information. I have a 2016 F-150, and I just did an oil change, which was really easy. Really easy. I'm looking for information on what needs to be done for chassis lube. I don't see any grease fittings, Zerk fittings. Dale actually says, where can I find that info? You know what, Dale? There probably aren't any grease fittings, or Zerk fittings, as you call it, old school. There aren't any Zerk fittings. They did away with those. We see those fewer and fewer, less and less. Chassis grease now is common sense stuff. You might be greasing the chassis stops, the steering wheel lock to locks when you turn the wheel full turn. You might be putting some silicon spray white or lithium grease on certain rubber components. But beyond that, there isn't a whole lot of chassis lubing or chassis greasing to do. So it's not something that's readily available or readily done anymore. You know, keep that in mind. I appreciate the thought, though, that you're looking for grease fittings. But the only place you're going to find grease fittings is maybe on the drive shaft, if that's a four-wheel drive or not. You didn't say that. But if it's a four-wheel drive, you may find grease fittings on the shafts themselves. But beyond that, grease fittings are gone. It lasts forever. You don't need that. You don't need to do that anymore. Hey, Ron, I listen to your podcast all the time. I got a 2017 Hyundai Santa Fe. This one comes to us from Daniel. I'm guessing in New York City. It's an NYC email. I've got a 2017 Hyundai Santa Fe Sport 2.4 front liter, front wheel drive, runs fine. I'm worried about carbon buildup on my valves. I was thinking about putting in an oil catch can. Would you recommend doing this? Is there a brand you'd recommend? Nah, you don't need to. You're overthinking this, Daniel. You know, there's no need for an oil catch can. What I would do is I would start using some fuel system additives if you're worried about carbon deposits, things like from Berryman Fuel Products. You know, take a look at their website, BerrymanProducts.com. Definitely some of their fuel system cleaners with Hest, their high-energy solvent technology, would do well in maintaining and keeping carbon deposits off. An occasional fuel system cleaning appropriate for the vehicle. A 17 Hyundai should be a GDI vehicle, gasoline direct injection. And they've got the kits for it as well out at BerrymanProducts.com. But putting an oil catch can in, you're realistically going to make it more complicated than it needs to be. No need. Hey, coming up next, Mike Muller. Everything you wanted to know about, what does it take to write a book about Corvettes as well as several other model lines? All that coming up, some really great stuff. I'm Ron Ananian, the Car Doctor. Don't go away. We're back right after this. Guest has been an automotive photojournalist since 1987, I believe his byline talks about, and he's a typical car guy. Not so typical, but he's into cars of all shapes and sizes. I actually knew him by name when the press release came across my desk, because I'm going, Mike Muller, I know this guy. He writes books about 55 Chevys, and lo and behold, it was a book about Corvette. Mike, welcome to the Car Doctor, sir. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
You've written so many books, It's kind of a jazz for me to be here talking to you. I actually have copies of your books in the studio. I'm a 55 Chevy guy, and I've got more than a few of yours. And I went, wait a minute, I know this guy. He's written a Corvette book now. I've got to talk to him. This is really kind of cool. So tell me a little bit about yourself. What turned Mike Mueller's clock that made him a car guy? Where did it happen?
Well, if you by chance have a copy of the book in front of you, or if some readers out there or listeners out there do, on the acknowledgments page, there's a photo of me with my first Corvette, circa 1960. I was about 2 years old, and for Christmas, I got a little plastic writing Corvette. And I don't remember getting it. I remember seeing it a couple years later, all busted up. But I guess that's where it started.
So it was that little car you got as a kid for Christmas, and isn't that funny? And I guess that's where this generation of car guys all seem to have started. Somebody gave us a car, or it was our first experience, or for me it was sitting on the fender while Dad worked on the car, but something when we were young, right? And it just stuck for a long time.
One of my earliest memories, I was about 4 or 5 when the 63 Stingray came out, and I don't have too many vivid memories from that age, but I do remember seeing my first Stingray on the street as a young boy and just going, wow, you know. And that cemented it even further.
Are you disappointed you didn't try and buy more of them when you were younger?
Yeah.
For what they're worth today?
Oh, my God. Well, I graduated high school in 1976, and there was still a kid driving a 63 Corvette convertible in a local high school parking lot.
Sure. Yeah. Listen, I tell the story from time to time. When I was a young kid, I worked at the horse stable down the street from the house, and Charlie, the kid I worked with, his father had given him the family's used Chevy to get back and forth to the stable. It was a 66 two-door coupe with a 327 and a four-speed, and we used to take it out into the horse pasture and do donuts because it was just it was just this old Chevy. It just, you know, I was all of 14 years old. Charlie had his license. He was 17, and it just didn't mean anything. And today, you know, we look at these things and we go, wow. So is Corvette your favorite, Mike? Because you've written about so many cars.
Yeah, I got to confess, I've been an automotive journalist dating back to my senior year at the University of Illinois. I started freelancing in 1983 for various magazines, and I've covered everything. And I mean, I have favorites to my heart, but I try not to be biased, and I've owned all makes over the years. I've never picked on, maybe I've picked a lot on Fords. I've got two Mustangs right now.
Right.
But I've covered everything, but obviously Corvette was my first favorite and always has been dear to my heart. And that's been the bulk of my book work. I have done Mustang books. And in fact, this very book that you're talking about, The Complete Book of Corvette, I have a brother to that, The Complete Book of Mustang.
I was going to say the picture work that you've done in The Complete Book of Corvette is phenomenal. And my question was going to be, you know, It's got to be an amazing amount of effort and time to collect all those pictures and to put them together in a book such as this, right? The color photography is outstanding.
And thanks for saying that, because I did about half of it myself, and that goes back 30 years of photographing Corvettes and all cars. I'm semi-retired now, and my knees aren't holding up as much as I used to. I used to travel the country nonstop.
Right.
Knocking on guys' doors, hey, can I photograph your car? You know, literally. And so a lot of that's mine. But interesting story, this is the fourth update of this book. The first one was done, about 2005. And back then, I physically had to go up to Detroit and to GM's archives, and they had just, quote-unquote, digitized it. I was able to go and sit at a computer and go through literally tens of thousands of photos. It wasn't long before that where a journalist like me who wanted to do photo research had to actually go through and look at, proof sheets, actual, pages of photos, you know. And fortunately, I was able to pick, it took me all day, 8 hours of work or more, and I picked out everything that I didn't have from GM and just clicked on the mouse and they came to my house.
GM just has a picture of one of everything at least that they've ever done, right?
Oh, Corvette guys would freak if they could do what I did, just to be able to sit there and look at photos all day.
You know, the rumor is GM has enough parts to build almost every car they've ever manufactured. I keep hearing this rumor. I don't know if that's true or if you can verify any of that. I've had friends that were engineers at GM, and they tell me that for legal liability issues, they have things in stock that they don't talk about. That and I asked, could they just go put together a V8 55 Chevy tomorrow? And they said, yeah, like it was brand new. It makes you wonder what they really have.
Yeah, well, there's an interesting story there. I did a book on classic American engines 10, 15 years ago, and I went up there to GM, and I said, hey, I need to photograph one of these old engines, and they pretty much had everything I asked for. They had them, they rolled them out on stands, and in fact, it was kind of a little bit of a clandestine operation. I went in the back door, and an old friend of mine up there with public affairs office said, sure, we'll help you. And I basically rolled the engines into somebody's office. You know?
Wow.
And I mean, I shot back to, early, the first Cadillac V8, 1916, or I forget what that year was, but shot some Corvette engines and the original, the first six cylinder, they had one of those on a stand. GM Archives, the Heritage Center, there's an incredible collection of everything GM, engine cars and experimentals and everything there.
Tell you what, Mike, can you stick around for two segments and we'll talk about that?
Sure.
Okay, stick around. Don't go anywhere. We want to cover that, too. I'm Ron Ananian, the Car Doctor, here with Mike Mueller, the author of Complete Book of Corvette, among other things. And we're just having a great car chat. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away.
Just like a picture, she was laying there, moonlight dancing off her hair. She woke up and took me by the hand. She's gonna love me in my Chevy van, and that's all right with me.
Welcome back. We're here talking with Mike Mueller. Mike's an automotive photojournalist since the late 80s. He's been a lifetime car enthusiast. He's written more than 30 automotive books, and just a real interesting guy to sit here and chat. So stick around while we do that. Mike, before we pulled away, you were telling us about GM and their archives and some of the things that you were up there photographing, and you referenced that they just seem to be rolling out old engines that haven't been in existence for a while like they were brand new.
Yes, they have a great collection of all the historical moments, whether it be, like I say, technological moments like the milestone engines or the cars themselves. And I think what's notable, too, a lot of people have seen their collection of all their experimental vehicles, which that in itself is, there's been various books done about those, too. They're just glorious, these wild flights of fancy, especially from the 50s, right after World War II, when the GM Motorama used to tour the nation with all the new cars plus all their new experimental. George Jetson-type vehicles.
Is that the next book Mike Mueller's going to write?
Well, it's been done before.
Yeah,
that hadn't stopped me in the past. But,
right, yeah. Well, you have a passion for it, Mike. I don't have to tell you that, but I want the listeners to know that. And they can't see what I can see either through the microphone or by looking at the book. The book is absolutely glorious, the Complete Book of Corvette. Now, I want to make sure the listeners are aware this is the most current version of the book, right? I think there's three or four versions that have been done up to date. This is the fourth version, I believe.
Yes.
If they're looking for it, where would they find it? I want to get that out.
Of course, Amazon is the perfect place. It's okay. Up there. Various. They sell it at the Corvette Museum in Bowling Green. Various outlets like that. But typically, Amazon is the one-stop shop for anything we all need.
Fair statement to say they're looking for the book that's got the red Corvette hood on it, the red cover.
Let's see. Yeah, the close-up of the badge on the new C8. Yeah,
right.
And of course that's the reason for this book. Well, the new car came out, and we definitely wanted to be on the, on the wave with that, and we got her out just in time. Of course, if you know anything about the news front with everything going on in this country, the 2020 Corvette came out just in time to be shut down.
Right. Yeah. There's
by the pandemic,
and the mid engines are sold out now. Correct.
Let's see. Obviously, they were waiting lines. The latest news I get is the production year is still going on, and they're going to try to keep building them through the end of the year. Typically, you know, the model year is over by now,
right.
Over, you know, by September. 2021s are waiting in the wings, but I think they're still hoping to build 20,000 of the 2020s. Initially, when all the plant shutdowns happened, they'd only built a few thousand. And for a while, it looked like it was going to be one of the rarest Corvette runs of all time. But they did have their goal, and they are trying to pursue that of building 20,000. Typically, all of them are spoken for, sure, you know. So
when you talk about the rare Corvette, Mike, and you cover it in the book, The Complete Book of Corvette, you know, things like the mention of L88 or ZL1, mm-hmm. you know, do the cars of today have the romance and the mysticism behind them that, you know, all you'd have to do is say ZL1 Corvette to somebody that's in the know and they know what you're talking about? Does a mid-engine trump that, do you think?
Well, of course, those legends have time on their side. You know, they just keep the legends keep getting bigger as the years go by, and it didn't help matters that the ZL1 these cars were so rare. You know, the L88, like the 67 L88, there was only 20 of them, and then in 68 and 69 they built a few hundred there, a few hundred there. But today's cars, the modern Corvette are just so incredible. Technological marvels. I mean, it's just incredible what they can do with a pushrod engine, a pushrod V8.
Right.
And it offers decent fuel economy. It runs like a kitten, and it's every bit as hot as those great legends from years past, you know. Hotter than most,
right,
you know.
Right, right. Nearly
500 horsepower now, and the ability to get upwards of 200 miles an hour, which... Yeah, what we need with that, I don't know.
Right. Well, you know, you wonder what we needed with half the cars we built in the 60s and the 70s, right? But there's still a market for it. Mike, I got a minute left. What's your favorite year Corvette, real quick?
Oh, gosh, probably the 67 and a coupe.
Yeah.
The last of the mid-year of the first Stingrays with the big block hood, with the Stinger. That's always been my favorite, I think.
It's been it for you. Ladies and gentlemen, Mike Muller, The Complete Book of Corvette. Mike, once again, where can the listeners go get a copy of this if they want it for that person in their life? We'll be giving away a few in the next couple of weeks, but for those that are out there holiday shopping, what's the best place?
Right there on Amazon. Just Google Complete Book of Corvette, and it'll pop right up. You can even Google my name, and it'll pop right up, I'm pretty sure. So.
Mike Muller, cool beans. All right. Hey, Mike, stay in touch. You write something else, you send me a copy. We'll talk about it. All right, brother?
Will do. Thank you.
You're very welcome. You take good care. I'm Ron Ananian, the Car Doctor. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. Once again, I want to thank Mike Muller for taking the time to sit and talk with us. And, you know, the one thing an interview like that can't do is help you, and that's what I was trying to do, and I hope I succeeded, in feeling the passion that it takes to write a book like this that I have in front of me. I'm sitting here reading it, and I'm seeing things that I wasn't aware of, not that I claim to know everything about Corvettes, but in 63, General Motors started building Grand Sports Corvettes specifically designed for racing. And they issued an edict where they were going to build 327, small 327s, right? All aluminum motors, all aluminum setups. And they built five of them. And then GM engineers, and he talks about this in the book, and GM engineers found out about it. They decided to enforce the ban that they had on racing where they weren't going to do any more track racing, and they ordered all five scrapped, but somehow they got out of GM's hands, and they're out there in a private collection. And supposedly now someone from Texas, a Texan, owns all five or maybe six Grand Sport Corvettes from 63. But it talks about the romance of it and how people created things with their hands and, you know, the thought process that went into doing things like this. I had a conversation with someone at the shop the other day, and here's my point. And we were talking about where will cars go in the future and the performance cars and, you know, repairing cars. And the person I was speaking with made a really astute observation. He said, you know, Ron, the reason people aren't into cars like they once were part of the problem is people don't even want to drive cars anymore. We've become a generation of people that want to push buttons and be driven around. And to a degree, that's true. And it's the cultural shift, right? It's the cultural change of cars and their impact as a transportation device. And it makes me wonder, it makes me sad a little bit, because I think that, you know, the performance industry may have seen better days. I'm not sure. But it just, you know, cars can do an awful lot for you. They do a lot more than just move you back and forth from A to B. They can take a wayward child and put them on the right path to life and help them become very successful. And that's something I'll never forget, having experienced it firsthand. Till the next time, I'm Ron Ananian and the Car Doctor, reminding each and every one of you, good mechanics aren't expensive. They're priceless. See ya.